guests. In our classroom this morning, we came in to find a family no one knew. They were shy, a little frightened, embarrassed. A man and his wife, pretty far along with a baby coming. A baby coming. Two little kids and a grandma. They'd moved into our classroom during the night. An iron bed and some pasteboard boxes, that's all they had. They'd cleaned the room first and arranged it, making a private place for themselves. I'm on the look for a job, the man said. The dust blew so mean last night I thought to shelter my family here a while. The two little kids turned their big eyes from Miss Freeland back to their father. I can't have my wife sleeping in the cold truck, not now. Not with the baby coming so soon. Miss Freeland said they could stay as long as they wanted. February, 1935. Family School. Every day we bring fixings for soup and put a big pot on to simmer. We share it at lunch with our guests, the family of migrants who have moved out from dust and depression and moved into our classroom. We are careful to take only so much to eat, making sure there's enough soup left in the pot for their supper. Some of us bring in toys and clothes for the children. I found a few things at my brother's and brought them to school. Little feed sack nighties, so small, so full of hope. Franklin never wore a one of the nighties Ma made him, except the one we buried him in. The man, Buddy Williams, helps out around the school, fixing windows and doors, and the bad spot on the steps, cleaning up the schoolyard so it never looks so good. The grandma takes care of the children, bringing them out when the dust isn't blowing, letting them chase tumbleweeds across the field behind the school. But when the dust blows, the family sits in their little apartment inside our classroom, studying Miss Freeland's lessons right alongside us. February, 1935. Birth. One morning when I arrive at school, Miss Freeland says to keep the kids out, that the baby is coming and no one can enter the building until the birthing is done. I think about Ma and how that birth went. I keep the kids out and listen behind me, praying for the sound of a baby crying into this world, and not the silence my brother brought with him. And then the cry comes, and I have to go away for a little while and just walk off the feelings. Miss Freeland rings the bell to call us in, but I'm not ready to come back yet. When I do come, I study how fine that baby girl is. How perfect. And that she is wearing a feed sack nightgown that was my brother's. February, 1935. Time to go. They left a couple weeks after the baby came, all of them crammed inside that rusty old truck. I ran half a mile in the dust to catch them. I didn't want to let that baby go. Wait for me, I cried, choking on the cloud that rose behind them. But they didn't hear me. They were heading west, and no one was looking back. February, 1935. Something sweet from moonshine. Ashby Derwin and his pal Rush had themselves a fine operation on the Cimarron River, where the water still runs a little, though the fish are mostly dead from the dust floating on the surface. Ashby and Rush were cooking up moonshine in their giant metal still on the bank when Sheriff Robertson caught them. He found jugs of finished whiskey and barrels of mash. He found 2 sacks of rye, and he found sugar. 1,000 pounds of sugar. The government men took Ashby and Rush off to Enid for breaking the law, but Sheriff Robertson stayed behind, took apart the still, washed away the whiskey and the mash, and thought about that sugar. All that sugar. 1/2 ton of sugar. Sheriff decided some should find its way into the mouths of us kids. Bake for them, Miss Freeland, he said. Bake them cakes and cookies and pies. Cook them custard and cobbler and crisp. Make them candy and taffy and apple pan dowdy. Apple pan dowdy? These kids, Sheriff Robertson said, ought to have something sweet to wash down their dusty milk. And so we did. February, 1935. Dreams. Each day after class lets out, each morning before it begins, I sit at the school piano and make my hands work. In spite of the pain, in spite of the stiffness and scars, I make my hands play piano. I have practiced my best piece over and over till my arms throb, because Thursday night, The Palace Theater is having a contest. Any man, woman, or child who sings, dances, reads, or plays worth a lick can climb onto that stage. Just register by 4 p.m. and give them a taste of what you can do, and you're in, performing for the crowd, warming up the audience for the Hazel Hurd players. I figure if I practice enough, I won't shame myself. And we sure could use the extra cash if I won. $3 first prize, $2 second, $1 third. But I don't know if I could win anything, not anymore. It's the playing I want most, the proving I can still do it, without Arlie making excuses. I have a hunger for more than food. I have a hunger bigger than Joy City. I want tongues to tie and eyes to shine at me like they do at Mad Dog Craddock. Of course, they never will, not with my hands all scarred up, looking like the earth itself, all parched and rough and cracking. But if I played right enough, maybe they would see past my hands. Maybe they could feel at ease with me again, and maybe then I could feel at ease with myself. February, 1935. The competition. I suppose everyone in Joy City and beyond, all the way to Felt and Keys and even Guyman, came to watch the talent show at the Palace Thursday night. Backstage, we were 17 amateur acts, our wild hearts pounding, our lips sticking to our teeth, our urge to empty ourselves top and bottom, made a sorry sight in front of the famous Hazel Hurd players. But they were kind to us, helped us with our makeup and our hair, showed us where to stand, how to bow, and the quickest route to the toilet. The audience hummed on the other side of the closed curtain. Ivy Huxford kept peeking out and giving reports of who was there, and how she never saw so many seats filled in the palace, and that she didn't think they could squeeze a rattlesnake into the back, even if he paid full price, the place was so packed. My father told me he'd come once chores were done. I guess he did. The Grover boys led us off. They worked a charm, Baby on the sax, Jake on the banjo, and Ben on the clarinet. The Baker family followed, playing just like they do at home every night after dinner. They didn't look nervous at all. The tap dancers? They rattled the teeth in their jaws and the eyeballs in their skulls, their feet flying, their arms swinging, their mouths gapping. Then Sonny Lee Hallam tumbled and leaped onto the stage, the sweat flying off her, spotting the palace floor. Marsh Wharton struggled out, his accordion leading the way. George and Agnes Harkins ran their fingers over the strings of their harps, made you want to look up into the heavens for angels. But only scenery and lights and ropes and sandbags hung overhead. And then there was me on piano. I went on somewhere near the backside of middle, getting more and more jittery with each act till my time came. I played Bye Bye Blackbird my own way, messing with the tempo. And the first part sounded like I used just my elbows. But the middle sounded good. In the end, I forgot I was even playing in front of the packed Palace Theater. I dropped right inside the music and didn't feel anything till after, when the clapping started. And that's when I noticed my hands hurting straight up to my shoulders. But the applause made me forget the pain. The audience roared when I finished. They came to their feet and I got third prize, $1, while Mad Dog Craddock singing won second. And Ben Grover and his crazy clarinet took first. The tap dancers pouted into their mirrors, peeling off their makeup and their smiles. Bertie Jasper claimed it was all my fault she didn't win, that the judges were just being nice to a cripple. But the Harp and Harkins were kind, and the Hazel Hurd players wrapped their long arms around me and said I was swell. And in the sweaty, dim chaos backstage, I ignored the pain running up and down my arms. I felt like I was part of something grand. But they had to give my ribbon and my dollar to my father, because I couldn't hold anything in my hands. February, 1935.